Hello and welcome to CodyCast, the podcast for debate, discussion, analysis and of issues related to geriatric and general medicine. So I'm Emma and today we've got with us Chris, Pete and Nick.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
And just before we start with our top tips today, I just thought I'd answer one of last week's questions about drug sick day rules in patients who've got Mediboxes. Because I asked one of the pharmacists at work and apparently... No, you can't really take them out, unfortunately. Some pharmacists write down next to the drug what colour and shape it is and what if it's got a little marking on it. But most people who've got a Medibox are either struggling with cognition or eyesight and carers aren't able to take them out. So that's our answer from last week's question.
So if someone can come up with a solution for that.
Yeah.
Feels like a bit of a... quality improvement project.
Yes.
If someone could work with a pharmacist, maybe if they could even start on a hospital ward, you could trial it and then see if you could take it from there, perhaps.
Yeah. So, who wants to kick us off with our tips this week, Chris?
I'll start from Tales from the Acute Medical Unit, I suppose. And we were discussing this week about inpatient management of community acquired pneumonia, which is obviously something that we see very commonly on medical admissions and on elderly care wards. And we were actually discussing about the role of steroids in management of pneumonia, and obviously quite frequently for people that have got underlying lung disease like asthma and COPD, if they're coming in with pneumonic exacerbations of those underlying lung diseases, then routine practice would be that we would give them a regular course of steroids during their inpatient management for usually for about a week. But actually that got us thinking about the wider guidance about steroid use in people with pneumonia generally, even if they've not got underlying lung disease. And we had a look at a Cochrane review from Christmas 2017, which was essentially looking at the benefits of using steroids in people with pneumonia of varying severities. They looked at 17 studies, which looked at about 2,500 participants, looking at the morbidity and mortality associated with and without steroid use in pneumonia. And to cut to the long and short of it, essentially they said that corticosteroids were beneficial for adults with severe pneumonia, regardless of underlying lung disease. Mm. And they also said that people with non-severe pneumonia, so we're talking curb 3 and below, and curb 3 and above as your cutoff for severe and non-severe, they felt that people that even if they didn't have severe pneumonia, they might actually benefit from corticosteroid therapy, but with no survival advantage. And if people have got a severe pneumonia of a curb 3 and above, the number needed to treat to avoid one death is 17 patients. So they felt that there was significant evidence to suggest that steroid use for everybody with a severe pneumonia would be beneficial. I'm reliably informed by some of the acute medical team in Carlisle that the BTS guidelines might actually be changing in the next year to reflect this, and we'd be prescribing steroids more widely for people with pneumonia.
And is that oral steroids?
Yeah.
Or are they...
Yeah. So they've analysed a number of studies which involve both oral and intravenous steroids, but obviously if people are critically unwell and they can't take oral steroids, then that would be IV hydrocortisone, but otherwise it would be routine oral prednisolone like you would do for your COPD and asthma exacerbations.
I hadn't heard that, so I've definitely learned something.
Absolutely, yeah. I'd not heard that before, yeah.
There you go.
Good tip.
Steroids and pneumonia in the future. Fantastic. See what happens.
Yeah. Thanks, Chris.
Excellent. So my tips about dysphagia, and the reason I thought to talk about this was we had a patient on our ward at the moment who had been kind of labelled as acute confusion for a couple of days during her inpatient stay, and actually turned out that she had dysphagia and had a stroke. And speaking to the stroke team, actually this isn't an uncommon finding that they come across for inpatients. So I thought I'd have a look at distinguishing dysphagia from kind of delirium. So just to recap, dysphagia is a disorder of language. It can be receptive, which is where you have a difficulty in comprehension, and their speech is usually quite fluent, but it's meaningless because they kind of fail to comprehend what they're saying. And that's the type that can often be confused with a delirious patient. You can also have expressive, which is where you have difficulty putting the words together. So their speech isn't fluent and they have quite a lot of grammatical errors. So why is it important to differentiate? I suppose a dysphagia is kind of a focal neurological lesion causing it, and a delirium is usually a global cause that's causing their symptoms. So I had a chat with a speech and language therapist at work. So clues when you're assessing a patient who is presenting as confused. First of all, consider, could it be a dysphagia? Look at other clinical features associated with delirium. So are they distractible? Do they have difficulty holding their attention? Are they disorientated? Is it fluctuating? Have they got altered perceptions like hallucinations and delusions? Patients with septal dysphagia are more likely to use words that they've just made up and paraphrases, which is where they just do substitutions of words. So they might be trying to say dog, but they say cat because it's in the same kind of animal category. Tip four, look carefully for other neurological deficit. So often with acute confused people, you look in the clerk and it just says neurology exam grossly normal, but we should be looking for any kind of focal deficits. Have they got a facial droop? Have they got some limb weakness? From the speech and language therapist, she said a good way is first of all ask them to follow stage one commands. So just ask them to do one thing, and if they can't do that, it might be a receptor's dysphagia, and also naming objects as well, because usually someone with delirium should be able to name a pen, but patients who have a dysphagia might not be able to. So they're the top tips.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Strokes, one of those important differentials that you do have to sort of keep in your back in your head when you meet a patient who's got a delirium. And similarly is when you meet a patient who's dizzy.
Yeah.
I mean, always watch them walk and do your cerebellar exam in case they've had a posterior circulation stroke.
Yeah.
I'm sure most of us at some point have been caught out by that one.
Yeah, definitely.
I think it also affects massively on treatment, doesn't it? Because early speech and language therapy intervention works really well for patients with acute stroke.
Exactly.
And if we've been faffing around treating them for a UTI or treating them for whatever other cause of delirium for a few days, it can really affect their outcome.
And getting them to a stroke
specific care, yeah, absolutely.
I think even if you can just take 30 seconds or a minute just to actually listen to what the person is actually saying and just focus on it, and if things sound a little bit strange or it's not quite right or they're clearly getting frustrated by what they're trying to say, that might also be an indicator that they might potentially have a dysphagia because they're getting frustrated at trying to express something that they can't.
Yeah.
And I suppose that really sudden onset is not something that you might typically see with a delirium, but you would with a stroke.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks, Em. Good one.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I might go next, as I've got a sort of speech and language related tip myself. And I wanted to talk a little bit about drooling and excess saliva, particularly in patients with Parkinson's disease. So having spent a lot of time this year working with patients with Parkinson's disease, one of the symptoms that you typically only hear about if you ask them about, but can actually be quite uncomfortable for them and quite uncomfortable socially for them, is the fact that patients with Parkinson's disease will often suffer from drooling and excess saliva. And the mechanism behind that is surprisingly straightforward. Essentially, when you have Parkinson's disease, you swallow less, and we all swallow our saliva unconsciously. But when you have Parkinson's disease, as you would expect with the bradykinesia of the motor deficit, you swallow less frequently, and also for many people, coordinating that swallow becomes more difficult. And as a result, you get an excess buildup of saliva and you get unexpected drooling as a result. And the reason I wanted to bring it up is, one is if you meet someone with Parkinson's disease, maybe in a clinic or maybe when you meet them in the community, as I said, it's something that's good to ask about because people might not raise it as an issue because it can be slightly embarrassing to talk about, but it can be affecting their sort of quality of life. Two, to think about that there are some simple things that can be done to try and improve it. So if you recommend people have something in their mouth that will encourage them to swallow, like sucking on a sweet or a mint, that having that stimulus there encourages them to swallow more and helps them keep their saliva down. Some people like to have a glass of water to sip to keep encouraging to swallow. Similarly, that you can have some people use prompts to swallow, so like a noise or counting, something that can work to prompt them to make a motion. So it works with helping the movement as well. If you've got a metronomic noise there, that can prompt you to swallow or move easier with Parkinson's disease. Finally, it is something that speech and language therapists will provide help and exercises to try and overcome. And I guess this was my major point, was that when you're thinking about trying to help people, this, that there is a therapist out there who is trained to try and improve the situation for people. And I will quite happily refer people who are struggling with drooling to a speech and language therapist. And I'd encourage others to do so as well.
That's really good. I wish I knew those tips before I did my Parkinson's clinic. Is there any medications?
So better control of their Parkinson's disease symptoms from a sort of levodopa point of view is obviously the first way you go. It will respond to treatment with that. Then further down the line, if that's no longer effective, then you can use drugs like hyoscine to reduce the amount of secretions they're making. Obviously, you've got the potential side effects associated with them, particularly the cognitive side effects you have to worry about. The stage after that is some people have Botox injections, which will help reduce the amount of saliva they have. That tends to work well, but is obviously that it wears off. So after a few months, they might need that as a regular treatment. So there are multiple other things, but I think the point I always wanted to stress is that there are therapy options as well.
Yeah, that's really good to know.
I think it's just an interesting point that actually a lot of people think Parkinson's, the main management is tremor, but actually it's often the non-motor symptoms of Parkinson's that cause people the most problems, and they're the things to ask about and manage, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sometimes you lose perspective, don't you? But if it was you who was having lots of problems with drooling, you know, how it would be embarrassing or isolated.
Exactly. We can't even imagine it being an issue, but if it suddenly became a problem, then it wouldn't be pleasant.
Top tip.
Top tip indeed.
Right,
Nicholas, I believe your last...
So last top tip of the day is from me. It's another medication-related one, same as last week. But this time I feel quite strongly about polypharmacy. And I think that I always worry about our patients who are on statins. We see loads of patients on statins who are becoming progressively frailer and trying to work out whether that statin is an appropriate medication for them. And that's something that actually you don't have to make the decision yourself. You can sit down with the patient or the patient relative to do that. But I never really knew the specific numbers and how to get hold of them. And there's a really good tool that we'll post a link to from the Mayo Clinic, where you type in the patient's demographics, including their sort of smoking status and lipid profile and what dose of statin they're on. And then it comes out with two sets of little squares. So it's 100 squares. And it's a really good visual aid at telling the patient how much risk benefit they're having in terms of cardiovascular disease. So how many of patients will have in their patients like them will have a heart attack in a year. So it's a really good visual tool to show them that actually this is doing exactly this much benefit, and that might help them come to a decision about whether they want to continue their statin or not, because often statin is a medication that patients feel have been drummed into that they should be taking regularly, and they can come to an informed decision about whether that's the right thing or not. And actually it's helped me as well as helping the patient, because it gives me a bit more of an idea as to how much benefit they're making. So it's a good useful tool.
I think it's a really nice tool, because statins in particular are drugs that make the headlines in the papers quite a lot.
Yeah.
And people working in the community or in clinics may very well face this question about, should I carry on taking this drug? And it's a nice tool like that to help, as you say, the patient make an more informed decision.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Very good.
Great tips all around. Thank you very much. And I'll put links to the papers and to the decision aids on the website. CodyCast is available on iTunes and the website, which is www.aeme.org.uk, and leave us any feedback there. And our Twitter handle is @elderlymeded, and we'd love to hear if you've learned any top tips this week. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thanks.